evening news. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zer, Ken and Rosalyn Scott. The producer is Eric Takeoff. Special thanks to Paul Rowland. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issues you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalyn Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris speak with Portland School Board member Steve Buell about the school board elections. At 9, Alternative Radio presents a classic speech by the late Howard Zinn. It's called Against War. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio features guest host Sarika Mehta. And at 11:30, Art Focus has the day off, but instead we'll hear Big Picture Science featuring a forensic scientist who developed tools to create a mugshot based on a snippet of DNA and a scientist working on mind reading. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in last week's membership drive. If you missed it, it's not too late to contribute. Just go to KBOO, KBOO, that is, .fm, and click on Donate Today.
Stay tuned now for a piece by Paul Rowland on Cascadia Day. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Rosalyn. Good night, Danielle.
And today is Cascadia Day. Happy Cascadia Day, everybody. Chosen by former Seattle University professor David McCloskey as a day to represent Cascadia because of its visceral reminder of the geological dynamism of our region, being the anniversary on this date of the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980. McCloskey also designed the by now widely known map of Cascadia around 30 years ago, which depicts a region from southeast Alaska down to the Klamath Siskiyou Mountains and from the coast to the Continental Divide. McCloskey was in Portland just yesterday to celebrate Cascadia Day and to share a striking new map, which he designed based upon previous work, which ties together the geology, terrain, and vegetation of the entire region in a dynamic and unique way. And this is some audio from yesterday at Laurelhurst Park in Portland.
I've been doing this for 30 years or so, and so this map is a culmination of that. So we started in our backyard. We started by mapping the watersheds of Seattle because the people running the show had no map to show us how the water worked in the place. It just came from in a pipe and went. So we got on our bicycles, found that bicycles were the best way, and Seattle's a city of hills. So bicycles are so sensitive to gravity. Walking is too slow, cars are too fast. So we got on our bicycles and rode the 50 hills of Seattle, fell in love with the place in a whole new way, and mapped the watersheds of Seattle. And then I mapped the Ish River, the interior sea, which is now called the Salish Sea.
Talking like the early 80s?
Yeah, early 80s. And then I mapped the ecoregions of Cascadia, 75 ecoregions of Cascadia, and then I mapped the bioregions of North America. So and Cascadia. And then so you have these series of scales, of nested ecologies from the local to the continental. So what we want are people to be able to find their way carefully and respectfully, stepwise, from their home to their neighborhood, from the neighborhood to the community to watershed, watershed to ecoregion, ecoregion to bioregion, bioregion to continent, and then to the planet. So this is an attempt to reground us in all those relationships. When I look at the map, what I see is the character of the place and the context of the place. So here we have the sea, and here we have the Cordillera and the mountains and the valleys, and then over there you've got the continent, the sea, blue sea floor, and then the green land.
And how long did it take you to develop this particular map here?
Well, this map required GIS help, so it was 2.5 years in making of this map and the smaller blue and green map over there that Alexander has up. And then this was about 5,000 hours of my time, which is pretty crazy when you think about it.
And you said you had to weave together all kinds of different maps from British Columbia and United States.
None of these images that you see here existed together. So the seafloor and the geology of the seafloor was actually not linked even very well to the coastline. And so then we had to marry the coastline and all these canyons and all of this stuff. And then we had to call out the contours of the bathymetric, the depths. None of those were all together. So this is the first time you've ever seen our seafloor in relation to the land all together. And I go, why haven't I seen that before? And then in terms of the boundary, that wasn't on there, because if you go up to Southeast Alaska leaves BC off, BC leaves Alaska off, and you can't find your way.
The deep sea, the seafloor is interesting, given that this volcanic activity that everybody's hearing about just off the coast now. Huh?
Well, tomorrow's Cascadia Day, that I named in terms of recognition after May 18th. Yeah. In Seattle, a boom, you know. It wasn't a little explosion. It was like the bowels of the earth were exploding. And it was, we were in Seattle, but it was so far away and so deep that it was. And then I went down to the local park, Cary Park, and watched the plume go up. And it went up and up and up and up and up, and the crowd got bigger and bigger. Cascadia Day celebrates that the earth is alive. So the story that we got out of that was, oh, destruction and so on. It wasn't about destruction. It was about that the earth is alive. And so now we could see in living time, there's on this map, there's Mount St. Helens or Lewis. And it is a direct result of the Cascadia subduction zone, which you can see right there. And that's the subduction zone, which is caused, that's the convergent margin, which is caused by the divergent margin, where these spreading ridges spread apart. And so all of a sudden, when it all comes together, you can go from, there's the mountain I see, there's the mountain blowing up I see, there's the deep earth structures, and now I can see them on a map. And all of a sudden, the world makes sense to me. It doesn't mean you should go into volcanic eruptions, but if you go earthquakes, if you go floods, if you go all these dynamic things, they aren't unusual. That's what the place does.
So what's the Cascadia Institute?
Well, it's dedicated to education about the dynamic character and context of the region here. We've run it for like 20, 30 years. And this is education, which is what the map is about.
Good way to celebrate Cascadia Day?
Yes.
Yeah, the earth is alive. It's dynamic. And as soon as you get that feeling, then this map will make sense. Otherwise, you can just stay in flat container space and be lost,
actually.
Bioregionalism is long-standing. I did not create it. Other people did. I've made the maps of this bioregion on various scales, as you see. But in terms of a multi-layered synthetic or synoptic integrative work that goes from the terrain to the geology to the vegetation and so on, this is the only map of its type. Now, the recognition of this is, do you know, you wouldn't know who Esri is. Esri is the company, a little bit smaller than Google, who make the GIS software and all the platforms. So every map these days in the world that is significant is made with GIS cartography, geographic information systems. Esri supplies those. So they're going to have a conference down in San Diego this summer. And they're going to have 15,000 attendees from all over the world. And their annual map book, which they give to all those attendees, has this map now, as of a month ago, on their cover. So now that means what's significant there is you don't have to know about bioregionalism. You don't have to know about Cascadia. You don't have to have any prior belief or ideological commitment or politics whatsoever to look at this map and appreciate this map and say it's beautiful. You can just approach it as something unto itself, and that's what they've done.
So say more about what you feel like the importance of the fact that you got on their cover. Who usually makes it onto their cover?
Well, Esri's this giant, basically, platform for GIS. And every year they have a map book. This is the 30th annual map book. So it's kind of there. Here's the best maps in the world this year. So we progressively got stage by stage invited in. And went through this step and step and step. Finally, I heard last or month that they're putting it on the cover. So that's a really big deal, because most maps these days come from agencies, bureaucracies, scientific organizations, corporations, cities, states, you know, they're big groups with, I mean, $100,000 budget for a map is not much. Me, I paid for this out of my pocket, and I'm retired. I'm living on Social Security, okay? So I put probably 5,000 hours of my own research time into making this. So literally, and then I had to learn it all. I did not know the geology enough to make this. I did not know the hardest things. People say, what were the hardest things? And you say, it's all, you know, you can get the digital elevation models, the terrain models. That wasn't hard. He did that. But nobody had the vegetation. So I had to create the framework to integrate all these hundreds and hundreds of different sets that I knew on the ground. The color palette, there are 60 colors. I don't know whether you've ever tried to create a color palette. Each color influences every other color in that field. So if you change one color, you're changing the resonance of the entire field. I almost lost my mind doing the color palette. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done. And so getting the veg, getting the color palette together, it was overwhelming. I don't think anybody else actually is crazy enough to have done this. Because it means you have to learn geology, you have to learn seafloor, you have to learn all these separate fields. So I had to go and make these forays and spend months and months learning these different fields and then putting it all together. So the strength of the map is its synthesis, its seamless synthesis.
You're a bioregional renaissance man.
Oh, I'm a tired fellow. Tired man. Glad to have it finished. So, to these folks here, they're semi-converted. But when the official maker of the platform for all maps in the world puts that on the cover, that means that just regular folks are going to get it. So this is going to be actually a pretty famous map now. It'll be online and so on, and it is basically the map of the year. Let me give you another story. Well, a better story. We'll talk about some other time. It's how a little guy makes the map of the year. How is that possible? That's a hell of a story.
Because you're not a professional cartographer, right?
No, I'm a retired professor. I don't have any cartographic skills.
Basically, by having this on the cover of Esri, you're having a bioregional revolution in cartography.
Yeah, and he says that, and I think this is another story.
Prone to grandiose.
No.
It's true. As a geographer, this is really a big thing.
But the key thing is that geography is in bad shape. It's like economics. Okay, and what geography did is lost its sense of place and stuck in space. And by space, they they decontextualize all geographic features and relationships and put as their primary concept space, which is Cartesian space, which is flat geometric space. And so then when we see a world and we look around us, the landscape, they see space. And so geography has become what I call spatiology, which is the metrics of distance, which means then our whole world is decontextualized. So they've lost all the relationships and all the depth and the dynamisms that creates our world. And it's just really pretty horrible. So the losses are almost incalculable when we try to understand not only where we live, but how it works where we live.
And how we live as well.
Well, that's it, yeah.
It's all part of the same thing.
It's exactly. So there's actually... I'm going to try to create a new website in the field called Cascading Geography. And that geography would be very, very different in nature than standard geography, because it'll put these relationships and configurations, relationship between locations and layers, and in suites of relationship. A simple little example is a rain shadow. Rain shadow is not a thing. A rain shadow is a phenomenon. And so a configurational geography, it means something different than geographers talk about a configurational geography. But it puts the gestalt, it puts these depths of relationships in motion for the first time. And so that geography does not exist, does not yet exist. And that's the one of the promise in formal terms of this map. So it's more a strategy. Basically, a map is an image of your place in some kind of rough scale, you know. Okay. Why have we never seen this before? Because not only geography, et cetera, because our whole mindset